In this podcast, I'm going to tell you about a crystal growing experiment, which meant that I spent a night in hospital. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. In this podcast, I'll go through how I got to hospital, the crystal I grew, and the story about that. Then I'll get back to my quest to grow more crystals. So the story starts off with me always growing crystals in the lab. So I always have a few beakers around. I'm growing crystals. At the moment, I'm just growing common salt crystals. Occasionally, I can get them to grow these large rectangular crystals up to 3 millimeters, 4 millimeters tall. I do something that always suddenly disappears, but occasionally I can get this one big crystal that I'm looking for. There are other things I do. I put different sites of salt crystals in, and it grows completely differently if you do that. I've just been pottering around for a long time always, and I've had podcasts in the past where I've described my discoveries, and I'll describe a discovery not to do with crystals, but it's also a very interesting aspect to do with crystal growth. But the story begins, obviously, I'm going to tell you about a crystal growth that wound me up in hospital. And I'll just go through. So you got the background that I grow crystals, more the background will fill in as I tell the story. So around 7 o'clock, the family had a meal. My wife's away in Canberra, so I'm looking after some of the kids. And we have some spaghetti bolognese. About 20 minutes afterwards, I start to get this pain in my not in my stomach, just beneath my heart area, I'm by myself, so I know that I've got to watch it. I've just had a heart operation. I'm going for another fix-up of the heart operation in about 2 weeks' time, so I'm given strict instructions to watch for this type of event occurring, and the critical thing is if I feel sweats, so I have a valve which they're going to stitch in more properly, stitch it in completely this time around, so they have to open me up in about 2 weeks' time. So I'm alert to this, and I phone a friend who comes along to ensure that I'm okay and looks after the kids, because I don't want to be a medical emergency without any help. And I'm going to describe a whole series of things, which is the way that it operates in Australia. Maybe the system that works in your country may be better or worse or different, but they saw what was going on and decided that perhaps I should go to the hospital. But the first protocol is in Australia is to dial 1-800-SICK, and this puts you onto a registered nurse who is there to basically triage you before you fill up an emergency department and try to smooth things over and report, so if there's a flu, they get a whole lot of quick information about, say, flu outbreak or food poisoning outbreak. Say suddenly the central place all gets the calls in, and they basically have a computer database and go through a series of questions and make a decision. And so my decision was to go to the local medical centre at within the next 6 hours, and they looked it up and told it where it was and the opening times. So within about an hour, I drove off to the local medical centre. So this is simply because it will close at midnight, so I couldn't actually wait till after the midnight time to go. And so I went to the medical centre, and they did a basic investigation. Yes, I was sore on the tummy, radiating pain in the back, and possibly a few other signs, which with the valve meant that it would be safest to go off to the emergency department. So we drove. So this is down from Glenbrook up at the Blue Mountains, down 200 metres to Penrith. About a kilometre further into Penrith, across from Penrith into Kingswood, is the Nepean Hospital. We go in there to emergency department. And they simply asked your name, date of birth, and a little green card, your Medicare number. But the name and date of birth, they want to cite the green card. All your medical records are pulled up on the database. And they know all about you. And then just a very brief description. Within about a quarter of an hour, 15 minutes, I was seen and triaged by a nurse. So you have to wait out there. Sometimes there can be a longer wait, and this was a Friday night. So usually if there's been some drinking or sporting events, there's usually a large wait in emergency, depends. But just very lucky that I went in. Very quickly, they took a blood pressure, took a bit of a history. In that time, the doctor I saw at the medical centre had sent them a letter covering everything. Then they began to lay me down on a bed and began to examine. To my surprise, they, within a minute or so, asked whether I was diabetic, pricked my finger, took the blood from my finger to take a sugar level, and within perhaps a minute they could tell what was going on. They put a cannula. This is a needle that they put permanently into your vein, and took a blood sample. And again, within 10 minutes, they had a complete liver sample. That's giving you a bit of it away. A complete blood type, a complete function test. Then asked a few more questions. Then they said, "Look, you'll be staying the night here," which I was a bit amazed by it all. Basically, they had one doctor came along and said, "Oh, look, you have a gallstone, that's what's causing the pain up there. It's not indigestion or anything like that." The rest of the family didn't have it, and the fact that it came on at the particular time after a meal and had a constant intensity and a constant feel. And so I went, was into the pre-admission bed, and the surgeon came in and said, "Oh, look, you have a gallstone. We'll probably take out the gallbladder tomorrow. It's a standard thing that we do, but we'll do an ultrasound first." So they had all this information very quickly. And I suppose this gives you sort of an idea of, I suppose, the general support, you know, why Australians are living so long to go on to it. And it was a classic textbook situation where the pain came on suddenly at a particular time after a meal and a particular intensity. It was, I would say, out of 10, I would say a 3, 2.75, which they round up to 3, fairly constant. And as they talked, they fed me Panadol, but almost as soon as they fed me Panadol, the pain started to go away. And by the time I had down the Panadol, the pain had dropped to what I'd say, not zero, but about 0.5. They said again, that's classic for passing a gallbladder stone, which is rather an amazing thing. What they would do is do ultrasounds, various tests to confirm. And in general, there's no mucking around, because it can, as they say, cause other serious problems to pancreas and other things, which can cause months of sickness and even death, apparently. And hopefully I'll get a bit more. Now, the story is that I'm home. I didn't have an operation. But then I went into a ward. Was very much looked after. The interesting thing is that they injected an antacid into me. which is, well, through the cannula, so it didn't worry me. It was one injection does everything, and fluid, and no fluid for up until after the ultrasound, after the clear that I wasn't going in for an operation. So it's a pretty spectacular thing overall to feel a bit of pain after a meal. The first time I've ever had it, and to have all of this. Now, the story is that your bladder produces bile, and the bile can crystallize and form two types of crystals. The most common type of crystal is a crystal of cholesterol. So the bile duct, the bile gallbladder, has a particular function. We'll go into that bit later, but what had happened is I'd formed a crystal, and a perfect crystal. I was aiming for many months. I actually did it myself inside, and of course this went down the small tube, and as it went down the small tube, caused this strange discomfort. Thinking back, it wasn't all that bad. It was just concerning in the conditions. And so I think by about after several tests and going across, about 2 o'clock the next day, I had the ultrasound. So I had fasted sufficiently and had not water. So I suppose there's no bile produced. Or I suppose if I ate, the bile duct would excrete its bile. So I suppose by that time, the bile duct should be full. And they did ultrasounds. And I suppose what's incredible now is the precision which ultrasounds can do. And so they looked and found that indeed I had produced a single perfect crystal. So there were no other gallstones there. And the tract, they could actually measure the width of the duct, the gallbladder, down into the intestine. I'll go into it a little bit more about what's going on. They could actually measure that all the way through and say, look, it couldn't have been a very large stone, because if it was a large stone, it will expand, and there could be some sort of infection associated with it, and it could even detect minute quantities of fluid. And in the meantime, they checked for kidney stones and looked at the liver, a whole series of fairly high precision tests, and wrote up a report. And I was back in the morning. I was seen by professors and students, and spent about 30 seconds while they looked at me and said, oh, you'll be out by the end of the day, just by looking at it. Eventually I was out by the end of the day. The report was written, and then they took a second set of bloods and liver function. And so the main thing is my liver function wasn't great, but it hadn't deteriorated, and the slight sign of infection had gone, because they also pumped me full of antibiotics. And so that was the end of the story. What I'd like to do now is stop and talk a little bit about the things I've discovered about the liver and and salts. So the first thing is, I thought, I know about a liver, about how it does the various functions. I know that it functions to store food, store sugar on demand. So basically the liver is the largest organ in your body, the heaviest organ in your body. And its function is sort of a bit like a Tesla battery. It's the digesting sugar goes in there and stores the sugar ready for you to use in the rest of the day. So your cells send out distress, hunger messages into your blood, which is interpreted by the liver, and it maintains a sugar level into your blood. The liver also removes toxins and from your blood. I know that much. And is responsible for producing a lot of things to do with the blood. It produces the albumin. This is that egg white type of stuff in your serum of your blood. These globular blood components, and it produces a lot of vitamins. Several months worth of vitamins is stored in this. I knew that much. I also knew this complicated system of draining and producing bile. So bile is an alkaline or soapy substance. So I had heard many years ago that in the abattoirs, it's hard to think, people would grab the bladders and use the bile as a soap to clean their hands. So it breaks up basic fat. So the bile, your liver, which is this large, boring organ. So occasionally I bring it into school to just one liver to dissect. And the kids are just amazed about how big it is and how boring it is. And you see a few holes in it where their blood comes in. So the liver is supplied by a direct artery from your heart, and also the flow of blood from your intestine and your spleen. The heart pumps to your intestine, and then the intestine has a large surface area sticking into your digested food, and that the digested food goes into the blood, then goes from that thing straight to your liver, and your liver cleans that junk and food up, gets the toxins out and the nutrients out, and stores it. So it's a very important thing. What I was amazed with, that when I checked it out, that the liver has over or an estimated 500 functions in the body. So it's very hard to make an artificial liver which covers all 500 functions. So it's a big, boring shaped organ with a lot of moving parts that you can see. And it sits there doing things. It's sort of like a car battery. It looks there, it doesn't really move, but it's very important for running the body. So coming out of the liver is the bile duct, which goes into the duodenum. So most people know about the esophagus. Your esophagus goes into the stomach. The stomach is basically a lot of hydrochloric acid, if you can imagine a bag of food you want to mush up, it's got this hydrochloric acid and it just squeezes it all the time. It just is continually squeezing and running it around, and the rumbling is when you can actually hear that, but it's rumbling all the time. Then it goes into out of the stomach sphincter into the duodenum, where it stays there. Now the duodenum comes from the Latin. Amazing, I've just picked this up just off the top of my head. Duodenum comes from 2 and 10, 12 fingers length. There's basically 12 fingers length of slightly wider intestine. So it's the duodenum is sort of the inlet to the intestine. So the stomach can actually just put its stuff there, and it's sort of a holding point. And in this duodenum is the point where the stomach acid is neutralized by the bile. So the bile comes in, and the bile then is like soap. It breaks up the fat and breaks up the surface of the food. So the fat would normally cover the nutrient of the food. I think there's this disgusting tasted low weight Canadian crisp, which is a low weight thing. It's got a special fat on it which cannot be broken down by the body, and it tastes disgusting. But the idea is that the fat keeps on top of the carbohydrate, so you can get the salt and the taste of a chip, but it actually don't get a chance to digest it. However, this is what the bile does. So normally the liver just delivers straight into the duodenum, which goes to the small intestine, 30 feet of that, or 6 meters of small intestine, and then after that's evolved, you actually drink your digestive material and form it into poo. So your large intestine has a large process of slowly reabsorbing all the water from your food. So it's a water-saving device. But going back up to the duodenum, which is just after your stomach, the bile goes through them. Now, obviously, your liver is producing bile fairly constantly, and when it's not wanted in the stomach, it gets diverted into your gallbladder. So it's your gall bladder is a little purse-shaped object underneath your liver. So your liver is sort of triangular shaped. I think it's largest on your left. I'm not sure. Going to smallest on your right, or vice versa, in your gallbladder. I think your gallbladder is on the right, and it's just this little patch. And so when you're not digesting, the bile goes to your gallbladder for greater for use. So it's not stored in there. And so when you suddenly have your meal, you kill your prey or something like that, you stuff it down your throat, you've got all this meat that you've eaten, lots of fat if you're very lucky. And then the meal goes in, it then squeezes the gallbladder. Of course, in this case, it squeezed this little crystal. So a lot of people can have quite a few stones in there, and stones or gravel in there. And this, of course, can be quite life-threatening, because if the stone gets stuck there, it's extremely painful. And one stone passes, and there's several stones in them. So the view is that, you know, if you've got one, you've got several. Now, of course, this is why they do the ultrasound. And I was lucky. I did my one. I had one gallstone. So I know people who have had theirs out have, say, swear by the fact that there's always thousands of them. But I was, I suppose, lucky to have it then. So it squeezes. So the typical gallbladder stone attack happens straight after the meal. Of course, I didn't know any of this, so I just presented, and they just, it sort of presented very, it would be a classic thing that I see all the time. So it was all news to me. Now, of course, one of the things, so that covers that, and it obviously takes a set amount of time depending on the size of the stone. Sort of the smaller the stone, the less intense, shorter duration of the pain. A very large stone, I should imagine, for days would coming through. And passing stones through through your kidneys and through your bladder. I do know in history of some famous people who have done this and not come out the best of it. So I'll just go on that point before I come back to my salt experiments and going through. So this won't be too long after it. Going back, there's obviously, I've studied Greek philosophers, and there's a Greek philosopher that very few people really know fully about, because he's very intensely important to biology, because he basically came up with a, and this is my own interpretation, so this is not accepted wildly, but he basically came up with the very first cell theory, that the actual, there were such things as particles, but particles knew how to cooperate with each other. They could move about and cooperate as a cooperative body, and that was a theory which actually survived in Europe and came in the German biological cell theory, Epicurus's theory. So just read into that. And Epicure refers to fine wine and fine dining, and which is really sort of like a Western reinterpretation of it. So his philosophy was to enjoy the simple things of life and to stop worrying and to actually just live in the moment. I'm not putting it too well. You have to read his original stuff. But it was a much more really focus on enjoying life. Now, obviously, people have taken this and said, well, this, if you want to enjoy what life, you have to have hotel grade sheets, fantastic things, waiters giving you wine, which probably tastes every other type of wine, and food which you could eat normally, but it's presented in a big plate, and everybody agrees with you that you're enjoying it. Epicure, it's in the newspapers, it's fine living, and I don't think this is what he was really into. But he had serious things. He used to drink, enjoy his wine. Of course, this gave him kidney stones, and he had a gigantic kidney stone, which eventually killed him, but he didn't require any anesthetic. He was just enjoying life so well. So he is one person who died through passing a stone, a very key philosopher in the history of philosophers. So that's a person. I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I probably have to read him up ahead of a podcast to tell you more about it. Another sort of famous person was Tycho Brahe. There's this person I've mentioned before, a Danish mad astronomer. Really, absolutely bonkers. He had a castle on an island, and it's sort of an amazing thing that you find out if you really read into it, that Shakespeare used to, the story about it, I'm talking about Shakespeare, I'm talking about this person, I'm talking about how he'll eventually die of a kidney stone. Okay, let's go into it. So this John Diggs, an astronomer, a British astronomer, the big news in that area of Renaissance history was a supernova. The supernova meant that it was a big astronomical event, so a lot of money went around in Europe, and Tycho Brahe got a lot of money. He was a Renaissance astronomer, and he didn't have a telescope. He had a metal star angle measurer. Before it was wood, he had a metal one, which was higher precision, and he was measuring the position of stars, and he managed to get a large fraction of the Danish economy. A lot of intrigue, a castle with secret passages in it, big parties with small dwarfs in it, and the Shakespeare aspect of it. Shakespeare visited his friend John Diggs, who had pictures on his wall of these Danish people, and John Diggs, the British astronomer, the English astronomer, would tell Shakespeare, who is very interested in it. And of course, this all came in, got reformulated in the play of Hamlet. So Hamlet, to all the English people, is all about the King of Denmark. The King of Denmark was actually, it's a play about the cosmos. And there's actually lines in Hamlet. When you listen to it, Shakespeare is clearly talking about the cosmos. Again, you'll probably be able to find, someone's written a paper on this for sure, somewhere on the internet for you to find out. But the other thing, I don't know whether it was Kepler. I have to be sure. I think it was Kepler. The student of Copernicus went up to Denmark and was at dinner with Tycho Brahe, and one of the things, there's a lot of alcohol up there. We know this because Tycho Brahe, there's lots of, if you really read into it, there's lots of alcohol lurking around the place, and lots of feasts, and these people were just, I suppose, ripping off the Danish royal family for what it's worth. Denmark was a lot bigger than, a lot more powerful than we know. So Denmark, I think, included Norway and Denmark. Norway and Denmark were one empire. So Denmark was quite a big going concern. So getting back, just how we know there was so much alcohol. Tycho Brahe had a moose, a pet moose. It's as mad as they get. And the pet moose we only know about because of a letter to Tycho Brahe about, "I'm sorry, your pet moose, I kept him," and he climbed up the castle keep to where we had the apple cider, and the moose got drunk and fell down. So there's all this evidence if you read into this history there. But the evidence here is that Kepler was trying to get the star positions from Tycho Brahe, carefully kept secret, and they have it in Denmark at the time that you couldn't leave the table to urinate, and in this big feast, this eventually caused so much pain that Tycho Brahe eventually died. So that's another point in history of it. Unfortunately, I haven't died from it. I think that's about all I can recall, I suppose other people will know about famous kidney stones and bile stones. But obviously, they're onto this, like anything. Now, the really interesting thing about it is that for me, obviously, there's one thing I know is I'm trying to grow crystals, but I know almost everything I do to grow a crystal destroys it. So I've now got a good catalogue of how you can destroy a crystal. So one of the things you can do if you've got a big crystal and you put in, you say, oh, I want to make it grow it long, I want to increase the concentration. One of the things which definitely destroys a crystal is putting smaller crystals in it. For that, always tends to destroy it. So I do have an armory of methods of destroying crystals. That's one thing I'm very good at. I'm not so good at growing my big magic crystal. So I began to think, oh, well, perhaps we can help here. And then I came across one of the most unusual chemicals that is actually used to chemically destroy bile crystals. So your gallbladder is a bladder which stores bile ready for your meal, so it can come out because it's only used there as a source, a digestive source. You can remove the source bottle, and this gallbladder stores your bile, and the bile sits there for a while mulling around, not doing much, and if it's the wrong consistency, the cholesterol will clump together and form a crystal. It's sort of an ideal little experiment. And Urshlo is this drug you can take for and it actually really dissolves gallbladder crystals remarkably well. And it's got a good chemical process of doing it. It's a particular type of bile, super bile, which you can take orally, and you can imagine orally because the entire liver is the bile comes out into the bloodstream and gets recycled. So it's like this recycled soap. So if you eat bile, that bile just gets added to your bile process. It's pretty pretty disgusting sort of thing. So this Urshlo dioxychloric, something to do with your stomach acid. And the Urshlo comes from Urshla, the Latin for bear. And much to my amazement, that I now sort of understand this Asian view of, and they used to keep bears, and what they do is they keep the bear and this poor bears in captivity and drain their bile. And to us in the West, this is an insane, inhumane sort of thing, this bizarre Chinese medicine which you would never think would work, but in fact it does work. And of course people can synthesize it, so we no longer need to do it, but it's a very interesting thing that I think it's UDCA. If you look that up on the internet, you'll find this. So there is indeed a chemical you can take, and it takes a few months for it to go down. And so this is something, if I was going down the surgery route, I'd sort of ask these various things, the interaction with this, and also a fairly interesting chemical when you look at the actual structure of it. It's a nice aromatic compound with as a nice molecule to look at. So there you go. That's me making a my own crystal. I was trying it on the outside, and my gallbladder beat me to it. And it's just a one-off single experiment. I'll just finish by saying that what I'm doing now is getting my salt solution. I don't know whether this will work. And I put it in a bath of gently boiling water. And indeed, it does show some signs of promise. So it's something I have to perfect. So there's these things where I'm experimenting printing at the moment, and I can actually rapidly grow a 1 millimeter crystal fairly quickly by various means that I'm looking at. And it's one of the major things is not adding too much water to your salt. You have your salt and you add it, just a few drops, and treat it various ways. And one of the ways I'm looking at is heating up the salt in a bath, trying to control the humidity of it. Now, of course, this is not going to be a fantastic crystal growth. It really fascinates me for various reasons. You've got a whole lot of physics determining why it grows in that macro crystal and how the actual processes. But the thing is that if you've got this basically a round see-through container in some boiling water, and it's just gently boiling, just the lowest, it's hot and it's at the lowest heat setting. And so there's a few areas of bubbles rising up, and a steam bubble will typically go from the hot plate, and as it goes up, implode, and it will just evaporate off the surface. But if you get this Chinese container or glass, I think it must be a light plastic container, and you push it down, it will start to boil very violently underneath. It's a bizarre effect. So if I do work out a method to grow the perfect crystal, I will tell you about it. But this is another thing that you can do. Get it onto the stove, obviously it's safe. Put about 5 centimeters of water, bring it to boil, but just very gently, and then put a plastic cup in it, a see-through plastic cup, and push it down gently. And so when you reduce the level of water, so the level of water will be 6 centimeters everywhere else, but underneath the cup it will be 1 to 2 centimeters, and that will boil very violently. So obviously this implosion, once the water goes, the water vapor goes up the bubble, implodes, that no longer happens in this area. So it's a very spectacular thing to see. So that's my podcast of a crystal growth actually inside you, something to think about, and perhaps it's a little journey I've taken you on through the Australian medical system. I don't know how it compares to everything overseas. Seems to be much better, but at least they're caring and onto it, and they didn't appear to miss a trick on this one. I'm sure if something else happened, something more seriously happened, there'd be more faults and things like that. But everyone was on board, and I went through the history of these stones appearing, people dying as they put it through, and this unusual cure, which is black bear bile, ursodeoxychloric acid, which you can take to treat gallbladder stones. So I hope that's interesting, and in the meantime, keep on doing science.